I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I realized the importance of self-care. Whether that's a 5 kilometer run, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5 minute dip in the sea, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Spotlight Oral Care. I know how important oral health is to our overall health and how we really need to look after our teeth and gums by using the best products. I've been using the Spotlight Oral Care Water Flosser. It removes bacteria from deep between the teeth and below the gum line, where traditional brushing and flossing cannot reach, while stimulating gums to improve circulation. Paired with my Sonic toothbrush, I love that it gives me a professional feel clean at home. Use discount code GOODGLOW25 at spotlightoralcare.com to get 25% off the entire range. Before I get into this week's episode, I just wanted to give you a warning that in this episode, we do discuss violence against women and sexual assault. This week, I'm chatting to Natasha Murta. Natasha has always had a love of travel. She packed her bags when she finished college and set off to adventure the world alone. She had some fascinating experiences along the way, things most of us could only dream of. We have such a gorgeous chat today about everything she did and everything she saw. Natasha also speaks about the night she was attacked by the driver of a water taxi in Panama as she made her way home one night. Terrified that she would be raped or murdered, Natasha jumped into the water, only to be pulled back onto the boat by the driver. Natasha speaks to me today about how she managed to escape this attack, how she recovered from the ordeal, and what she did next. In the wake of the death of Sarah Everard in London, I think it's important to address the issue of women's safety, and Natasha speaks so well on the subject. I'll leave details on helplines in this episode's show notes. Natasha, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted you asked.
Yeah, it's so nice to catch up. I was listening to your interview on the Brendan O'Connor show and I was glued to every word that you said. So thank you so much for agreeing to tell your story on the Good Glow today. I wanted to start with, I suppose, your love of travel and where did that come from?
I think I had it in me from a very, very young age because my dad has always loved travel. He's a huge, he's mad into adventuring and seeing other countries and just adventure in general. And since my brother and I were very young, he would take us away. Like I remember when I was just 12, he took the two of us to Iceland and we went camping and hiking on glaciers. And when I was 16, dad took me on the Camino in Spain and we walked that together. And then we did it again when I was 18. And you know, in sixth year, when everyone else was going on the sixth year holiday, me and a group of friends went into railing. And so it's just sort of been this gradual build in me. And then I knew from a very early age that I wanted to finish school, get my degree done, and then just go and see as much of the world as I could before I needed to come back and get a real job and start life properly. And so I did that. I went to UCD and I studied English literature and philosophy. And I didn't even wait around for my graduation. I just hopped on a plane and I went and did my J1. And then I came back for, I think, 10 months and worked in the restaurant that I've been working in since I was 15, squirreling away as much money as I could. And then the original plan was actually to move to Australia. So back then I was 21. And as I sort of did a bit more research into Australia, I kind of got the feeling that it was kind of like Ireland in the sun. There's an enormous amount of Irish people out there. And I felt that I wanted something a little bit more of an experience. And so that brought me to Africa. And I just thought, I've never been there. I would love to go there. And I bought a one-way ticket and I packed a bag full of stuff and I saved 6,000 euro. So I had in my head that I would go away for around 6 months. You know, I was just going to see how far I could go. And so I stayed in Kenya for 3 months and I was living in a village outside Nairobi called Gong. And I was working with a lovely little orphanage. And helping out with the kids and just had the most wonderful 3 months, and I spent nothing. It was my money carried me a lot further than I thought. So then I decided to fly to Costa Rica, which, looking back, I mean, that was so stupid because you couldn't have picked, like, talk about going from one side of the world to the other. I should have explored more of the countries that were closer to Africa. But anyway, I always wanted to go to Costa Rica because I wanted to see the rainforests, and I knew that I'd get great hiking out there. So I arrived in Costa Rica and went all around Costa Rica. I rented a little motorbike and went up to the cloud forest, did all the beaches. I mean, it was just amazing, amazing. And then I just kept going. I had no plan. I know that I wanted to see as many places as possible with the little money that I had. But it was great that I was in Central America because it's so cheap there and the countries are so close together. You can just literally fly through them. And so I just kept going south and went over into Panama and went into Bocas del Toro, where all those islands are. And then I went into Colombia, and then I just sort of saw my money getting a little bit thin and I wasn't ready to go home. I thought I would be ready when my money, you know, was starting to run out, but I felt like I had just started the adventure. And while I was traveling, I met other travelers that were doing this, what's it called, workaway. So it's where you work in a hotel or a hostel or, you know, a resort, and you get your bed and your breakfast, but you don't get paid. So it's a way of making the little money you have last a little bit longer. And I'd fallen in love with Bocas del Toro. So I thought, okay, I'll go back up there and I'll try and get something there, and that will, you know, make my money last a little bit longer. And so that's when I started working in the Garden of Eden, which is a resort on Isla Salarte in the Caribbean in Panama. And not only did I get my bed and food, I also got all of the tips because I would clean the rooms, I would do the cooking, I would do everything. It was kind of like a one-woman show. And by the end of, I think, 7 months later, I had nearly $5,000. And it was all in cash, which was a bit tricky. But I just thought, this is brilliant. I can go and see so many more places. But I was also aware that I wanted to fly back to Ireland from a country where my flight wouldn't be extortionate. So, you know, if I was to fly home from, say, Brazil or Colombia, it would have cost me an arm and a leg. So I figured I'd start going back up towards Mexico, because flights from Mexico to Ireland, you know, they can be as cheap as $200. So I did that, wiggling my way back up all through the wonderful countries of Central America. And then I couldn't leave Guatemala. I was supposed to be in this town called Antigua, which is a colonial town surrounded by volcanoes. I was supposed to be there for 3 days. And I think on day four, I signed a year-long contract to be a volcano tour guide.
Wow. And like, when you were doing this traveling, how long were you gone at this point when you signed the contract to do the volcanoes?
I had been gone for, I think, just over 18 months.
Right. And what was the contact like with your parents? You know, were they encouraging you to follow your heart and do what felt right? Or were they worried about you?
They weren't worried. I think they've always believed that I'm very capable on my own. And I think mum was probably a little bit more worried than my father, but dad was just so excited for me. And I remember when I actually had a flight booked from Mexico to Dublin. And so when I signed this contract, I was like, oh God, I have to call my parents now and tell them that yet another flight is going to be missed. I think at this point it was my second flight home that I had booked. And I remember calling mum first, and I remembered the conversation so well. I said, mum, you know that flight? She said, hello, darling. I said, hi, mum. You know that flight that I'm supposed to get on in a week? And she goes, yes. I was like, I'm not going to get on it anymore. And she goes, oh. And I was like, I just signed a contract to be a volcano tour guide. It's going to be so cool. And my dad was in Spain at the time doing something for the Irish Times. And mum goes, well, I suppose you better call your father. And so I told dad the exact same thing. And he said, that's my girl.
No way. And what sort of what was your day like when you're a volcano tour guide?
So it's the reason I got the job was because I was sitting in an Irish pub called The Snug, and I never, ever, ever went to Irish pubs when I was on my own. But at this stage, I was a little bit homesick, and I saw this glowing shamrock coming out of a wall, and I thought, ooh, went in there, and I was sitting at the bar having a few beers. And this man called Victor walked in. He's from Alabama. And, you know, he came in with this T-shirt and it said Ox Outdoor Expeditions. And he had a big bag on him. And he really looked like the outdoorsy type. And we started chatting. And he told me that he had this adventure company in Antigua, Guatemala. And they led guided tours up these volcanoes, up Agua Fuego, Bacaya and Acatenango. And I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. And one of the things to do when you're in Antigua, it's the number one thing to do is hike up Acatenango. It's 3,984 meter high volcano. And it is now dormant, but its sister volcano is Fuego and it's just below it. And when the plates moved, they used to share one magma chamber, and now Fuego has the entire magma chamber. So Fuego is constantly erupting. I mean, there's lava coming out of it. It is constant. So they do these hikes where you hike up Acatenango. It takes about 5 hours. It's a really tough hike, but then you camp there and you're literally looking across to this other volcano and watching lava shoot up into the air. And I really wanted to do it, but it cost around $100. And because I was running down to the last few euros, I didn't think I was going to get to do it. And so when this man started talking about this company he owned, and he was like, you know, you sound like you'd make a really good guide. We're actually looking for guides. You know, would you think about it? And me being sneaky in my head, I was like, well, maybe I'll go up on a test run, you know, and just get a free trip, and then I'll just scoot and off I go. And so Victor was like, yeah, why don't you hop on one of our tours and, you know, maybe you'll like it and see what you think. I had full intentions to just go on the tour and then just scoot. And I was up there and it was pitch black, and I was looking at this Fuego shoot lava like 2 kilometers up into the air, and like boulders smashing down and the noise, and it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen in my whole life. You know, I was saying to him, when I told my dad about it, you know, he was like, you know, I'm 58 years old and never in my whole life have I ever seen real lava. And I think most people would probably say the same. It was such a, it was such an amazing experience to actually see a real life lava. And I came down off the volcano and went straight into the office and signed it without a shadow of a doubt. And so then what happened, I had to do 2 weeks of training, physical and learning all about the different things on the volcano so that I could actually answer questions that my clients would have. So once I passed the 2 week test, I became an official guide. And so my day would start at 4:30 in the morning. I would leave my apartment, I'd cycle my bike down to the office, and I would have previously met all of my clients the night before and given them a bit of a debrief and, oh, you know, what you need to bring and snacks and water, and I would provide the full 3 meals. And so I would give out all of the gear to my various different clients, you know, sleeping bags, this. I'd give everybody a bit of the tent, a little bit of the food, and I'd share out the load. And then we'd get in the van at 5:30, and the van would drive us up to the bottom of Acatenango, and we'd get out. And so we'd usually start hiking at about 6:45. And so there's loads of different layers to the volcano. And the first part is through farmland. So you're sort of cutting through these fields, and you see, you know, the farmers working away, and then you slowly go into, you know, the tall tree layer, and then there's the cloud layer, and it's about 5 hours long, and we make little stops along the way, and, you know, you can see the sea, you can see the border with El Salvador, you know, there's lots of little things to point out to your clients. And I would usually have around 10 clients to myself. In high season, the most I ever had was 18, which was tough. And so we'd get to the base camp then at around 2 o'clock. I'd set up all the tents, and then everyone could just sort of relax and enjoy the view of the volcano exploding. And then we'd make a campfire. I'd cook the dinner over the stove, give it all out. We'd have a little bit of red wine. And then we'd go to sleep. A lot of the people obviously didn't. They just lay there in their tents with the doors open, looking at this incredible scene. And then we woke up again at 3 a.m. and we just did the final last summit. I think it was only about 250 meters, but it's very, very tough. The air at that point is very thin. And so you get to then to the very, very, very top of it. And I've never felt like I was more on top of the world than I did when I was standing on top of that volcano and seeing everybody else's reaction never, ever, ever got old.
Wow.
And so we'd watch the sun rise and then we go back down to the base camp. We'd have a little bit of breakfast, pack everything up and then go back down. And so from start to finish, it was about 4 a.m. would be when I would leave my apartment. And then I'd get back to my apartment the next day at around 5 p.m.
It's very tiring work, but did you feel, you were obviously fiercely independent. Did you feel lonely when you were traveling, or do you get this kind of contentment and meet other people and they kind of, that power of human connection keeps you going? How did you feel?
I never, ever, ever felt lonely. I never felt lonely because you never are lonely. And if there's anybody listening to this thinking about going traveling, the best thing you could do is go on your own because you will never feel lonely. You know, you'll be forced to do things that you wouldn't do if you were with a friend or a partner. Mm. And it's easier to fit into groups when you're on your own. And, you know, with doing tours or adventure things or booking into something, it's always easier to fill one spot rather than a group of four. So you find yourself constantly being mixed with other people that are on their own or couples or this or that. And you just make friends and you become more and more confident as it goes along, as you go along. And one of the other reasons that I really wanted to go on my own was because when I was younger, I was such a people pleaser and I really hated it about myself. And I often found I would get into these situations that I really didn't want to be in just to please, you know, my friends or, and so I said, I want to go traveling on my own so that I don't have anyone to have to please and that I just learn to actually do exactly what I want in life. And it was the best decision I ever made.
Wow.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. But first, I wanted to give you an update on Spotlight Oral Care. Spotlight Oral Care understands that as oral care is so personal, it can be difficult to know where to start. This is where their brand new online advisory service comes in. In 3 easy steps, you can chat with the Spotlight consultant who will listen, address, and guide you through your oral care queries, build a personalized plan just for you, and it's a completely free service. Check out spotlightoralcare.com for more.
That's amazing. So fascinating. There's a couple of books in you, I'm sure. But you were on Brendan O'Connor talking about an experience that happened to you in Panama and a very frightening experience. And you were so courageous in telling the story because I know going back to that time is probably upsetting. But do you want to tell us a little bit about what happened? Yeah. Because it's... One thing I did take from the story when I heard it is that you had people around you, you know, to comfort you and mind you, so you weren't completely alone.
Yeah. So this happened during the 7 months that I was living in Panama when I was working in that resort called the Garden of Eden. And as I was saying, Bocas del Toro is an archipelago, so it's loads of little islands. And the way that you get around is through a water taxi, which is just your bog standard rowing boat with an engine plonked on the back. And I was, because it was my last night before I headed off again, I wanted to go back to the mainland and have a couple of drinks with the few people that I'd become friends with. And I'd done this so many times, gone to the mainland and gone to a bar and then gone home again. But unfortunately, on this night, I remember going to the taxi dock, as I normally did. It was probably about 1 a.m. And I remember being very, very much, sober. I'd probably had about 4 cocktails. I don't know. But I remember everything, apart from the fact that this is going back 5 years ago now. But I got into this boat and it was just me and the boatman, and I was sitting at the bow of the boat, and he starts the engine and we start driving out towards Isla Slarte, which is where I was living. And there comes a part of the journey where you're going sort of smack bang in the middle of lots of other islands, so it's totally black water and there isn't anything on either side for about, you know, 2 kilometers, and you're just sort of using the moon to light the way. It was always a really stunning ride home, really lovely. But on this occasion, the engine was cut. I remember turning around to look at the boatman to wonder why the engine had cut out. And I thought, if the engine had cut out by mistake, he'd be looking at the engine, but he was looking directly at me. And I just remember feeling that, you know, your blood runs cold and, this isn't great. And he asked me to pay now, which wasn't the norm. But I said, okay, yeah, gave him the money. He said, I want more money. So I gave him more money, which wasn't a lot. And then he started laughing and he started climbing up towards me on the boat, hopping over the benches. And I was wearing a strapless play suit at the time. And he pulled the top of my play suit down, exposing my chest. And then the next like three or five seconds was just all very fast. I remember pushing and saying, please no, and all of this stuff. And I then jumped out of the boat into the sea because I thought, well, I mean, he's going to try and rape me. If I stay in the boat, it's going to happen. If I get in the water, I actually don't know what will happen. So, you know, I obviously wasn't thinking right. But anyway, the engine comes back on and boat comes back over to me and he pulls me back into the boat, which was extremely painful. And I was, you know, crying and sobbing, and I can't remember what he was saying, but I then said, if you do anything to hurt me, Rasta Miguel will kill you. And Rasta Miguel was this wonderful man. He was about 50 back then, about 6'2", Rastafarian local man with dreadlocks down to his knees. And it's important that I mention the dreadlocks, because I didn't realize that there was this real thing about dreadlocks. And, you know, if you have really, really long dreadlocks in the Caribbean, it's almost like a symbol of respect and your sort of status within the Rasta, you know, community. Miguel, he had, you know, 5 kids and a wife, and he was born and raised on the island, and he'll die on the island. And he was the chef in the resort that I was working in. And he taught me how to cook Caribbean food, and we became friends. And anytime we go back to the mainland to get fruit or vegetables or fish or whatever, and we'd walk down the street together, every single person would, hello, Miguel, Rasta Miguel. I mean, I just felt like the coolest person ever walking beside him. I was like, I'm friends with Miguel. And so in this moment of panic and dread, I thought of Miguel and I said, you're going to be in so much trouble when Miguel finds out what you've done. And his face changed and the whole situation changed within a matter of seconds. And the man turned the engine on and he kept saying, I was only joking. I was only joking. Why did you get into the sea? You know, laughing and laughing. And I was just sitting there absolutely terrified. My back was in an incredible amount of pain from being brought in over the boat. And as soon as the boat was close enough to the dock, I jumped out of the boat and I ran straight up to the main house where my bosses, Dave and Sue, were asleep in their bed. And I burst into their bedroom. And when, you know, it was hysterical, Dave left the room and Sue, you know, got me into her bed with her, and I fell asleep with Sue that night. And the next morning, you know, they took it very seriously and they asked me what I wanted to do. I wanted to leave. I want to go home. I just wanted to get away and forget about it and carry on my wonderful adventure. And Sue said, Miguel is on his way over here. And we told him what happened and he's extremely upset about it. So when I saw Miguel, there was no questions about it. I was getting straight into Miguel's boat and we were going to go to the water taxi rank and I was going to identify this man, which is exactly what we did do. I stayed in the boat, but I remember Miguel going over. There was a conversation, and long story short, the man had his license stripped from him. And I thought, gosh, like, that's a really great victory. Like, no other young woman is going to get in this boat again. And Miguel said, you know, unfortunately, this is a man's world and he will probably get that license back within a month. You know, once you're gone, things will go back to normal. It's not enough. We have to go to his house so I can tell his wife what he did. And so Miguel drove over to the house because everyone knows everyone over there. And I again stayed in the boat. And I remember the woman coming to the door and she was holding a baby on her hip. And Miguel told the woman what he had done to me. And that was, I suppose, the harsh justice that Miguel thought needed to happen. And then I left. I didn't stay around for another day. You know, I was so thankful for Miguel, but I wanted to leave. I didn't want my wonderful memories of Bocas del Toro to be tarnished by this event. I just wanted to leave.
And how did you feel, you know, the morning after or going to identify this man? Were you in shock? Were you traumatized?
Weirdly, no, I wasn't. And even though, you know, you say, gosh, it must have been hard for you to talk about this on the Brendan O'Connor show, I don't find it hard to talk about because I never remember feeling trauma. And obviously it could have gone so horribly wrong. I mean, I could have been raped and or murdered and I was neither. It could have gone so badly, but I don't know whether it was because once Miguel was brought into the situation, all of the scariness was taken away because he was such a protector, you know, physically and mentally. Like, he's this huge man and he's very caring and gentle. I don't know what it was, but no, I didn't feel, I think probably the thing I felt the most was the excruciating pain from my back. And even when I saw the man again, I didn't have this, you know, irk feeling inside me. I don't remember feeling that. But yeah, I just didn't feel that sort of trauma that you would expect, which is weird. And I continued traveling on my own as a female. So it didn't do the damage that one would expect.
And when you told people about it, you know, what was their reactions? Or did you choose to share it?
The first time I ever shared it was when it was published in the Irish Times.
Really?
Yeah, which my parents nearly, they were like, what the bloody hell is this? I hadn't told anybody, you know, even when I was traveling back up through Costa Rica, back into Nicaragua, and then I got to Guatemala, didn't tell anyone, didn't share it with anybody I met on a bus, and I didn't feel it necessary to share, really. And yeah. Then it wasn't until I'd signed my contract as the tour guide, and I was living in this wonderful little house in Antigua. And there was a new girl that was moving into the same building, Zanka, and she was from Hungary. Really lovely girl. But we were standing in the kitchen one time and I was cooking, and she was just new in Guatemala. She'd only been there like, you know, a week. And she was asking me, was it safe in Antigua to walk home alone and all this kind of stuff? And I said, look, what I've learned is it isn't safe to walk alone at night anywhere. You know, don't do it. And I went to tell her I wasn't telling her the story about the boat. There was another incident in Antigua where I was walking home alone. Like, it was literally one block. It was dark. And, you know, some guy tried to rob my handbag unsuccessfully. But I was telling Zanka this. And she interrupted me and she said, you're so stupid. As a woman, you should know better. And I thought, what? I'm sharing something with you and you've just called me stupid. And I was so furious that she saw the stupidity in me rather than saying, God, isn't it annoying that as women we cannot feel safe anywhere? Because that's how I would have reacted. And so I wrote this blog post about how this woman's reaction made me feel just so fed up and annoyed. And okay, so, you know, if you take the boat example, if someone criticized me in that, how was I supposed to get home? Was I supposed to swim? I had to get a water taxi. You know, it wasn't my actions. It was the situation that occurred and the fact that I'm a woman. That is the issue. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up writing all about this. And Roisin Ingle from the Irish Times contacted me and said, you know, will I rewrite that for the Irish Times? And it would be published on International Women's Day. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. What a way to turn, you know, negative narrative into possibly something positive. And this is going back a long time now. So it was before the conversation had really started on this whole subject. So it was published and nobody contacted me to do like a radio interview or anything else. It just sort of was published and that was it. And I was like, this is so cool. You know, I'm only 20 something and I've got a published article in the Irish Times. And then a couple of days later, I stupidly started reading all of the comments on the article. And I couldn't believe what I was reading. All of the comments, there were, I think, 64 comments, and 7 of them were positive and the rest were absolutely tearing me apart. I mean, before anything, I'm a young girl who's just, I wasn't a journalist back then. I was a young girl sharing my story. How horrible for people to tear me apart like that. I remember one woman said, you know, my daughter wouldn't even wear that in Ireland, let alone a foreign country. But then again, she's not an exhibitionist.
And you were just wearing a pair of shorts.
I was wearing a pair of orange shorts. They weren't even tight. I mean, you can see the photo in the article, and a black baggy T-shirt and a pair of Doc Martens. And I'm sitting there with my dog. That's the photo. And, you know, the other comments were, Natasha, you are encouraging other young women to put themselves in dangerous positions. You know, your article is very damaging. The Irish Times should have done better. I mean, they were really, really, really tearing into me. And I just couldn't believe it. And so anyway, time went on. Fast forward 6-7 years, whatever it's been. And it was International Women's Day the other week, as we know. And I didn't post anything. You know, normally I would have posted a picture of my mom or my friends and, you know, said something like, oh, these are the wonderful women around me. But because of the things that were sort of happening right around this International Women's Day, I felt that there was very little to celebrate being a woman in the current climate. And then it wasn't until the day that Sarah Everard's body was found that I remember feeling the same fury that I did when Zanka called me a stupid girl, because I went onto Twitter and I think it was under the BBC post of the news. There were a number of comments from men predominantly questioning why she was walking and not getting a taxi. And first of all, Sarah did everything by the book. She rang her boyfriend before she left. She walked on lit streets. There were streets with CCTV. It wasn't even late and she was 50 minutes away from home. You know, it's coming closer to summer. It probably wasn't cold. She wanted to walk. Why are we saying, why didn't she get a taxi? Why was she raped? And so I tweeted, you know, all of those. I got all the nasty little comments that were put under my article and I just retweeted it saying, I shared a very upsetting story with the world 7 years ago. And these were some of the comments that I saw. And it's reminding me of some of the comments that I'm seeing on this poor woman, Sarah. And we need to stop this now. And we need to stop getting women to shout for protection. And we need to start educating men not to rape us.
You shared your article again. And what was the difference in the reaction now than a couple of years ago?
Enormous. I think if there had been anyone to comment anything negative, you know, Twitter would have combust and they would have been taken down, you know. The difference was huge. And that's a really good question because it was very interesting. And it does show how things are changing. Because on the comments under the Irish Times article, there was a couple of people trying to defend me and stuff, but it was just sort of like nasty, horrible, angry stuff. And this time round, I got an unbelievable amount of support. I think I tweeted this thing at like 9 o'clock, went to bed. And when I put my phone down, the tweet had gone semi-viral and my inbox was flooded with people asking me to come on and talk about this and share this and how it was so awful. So the difference was enormous and thank God.
Yeah. And what do you think has changed? You know, like, is it because women are, I don't know, more vocal or social media or sharing of stories? Like, what has changed, do you think, that it seems to have come to the point where enough is enough?
I think I would hate to think that more women are being raped now, and I don't think that is the case. I think unfortunately women have were being raped and murdered for years and years and years now. That's not the difference. I think it's a couple of things. Social media, definitely. I think one of the great positives about social media is it makes it easier for somebody that might be feeling particularly vulnerable in sharing their story. It's like a little bit of a curtain to feel you, to make you feel somewhat protected sometimes. But I also think it is this narrative has been building and building and building and building. And the more women and men get raped as well, the more people that come out and talk about this, the stronger we are as a collective. But I think also the difference now is women are really tired. And that sort of fear that we have walking on the streets has now turned into it's something else. You know, we're tired of being scared. I'm tired of fearing what would happen if X, Y, and Z. And, you know, it's not just a woman in a boat in the Caribbean at night who's vulnerable. It's a woman walking through the park. It's a woman on a run by the canal. It's a woman, you know, asleep in her own house and there's a house party. It's women everywhere. You know, we don't need to be taught how to look after ourselves any more than we already have been. We need to change the way men are growing up. And that's why I think that this needs to be a conversation that we bring into schools, into universities, into clubs, societies. And we need to start teaching young people that this is something that's very, very serious.
I think, like, since Sarah was murdered, I actually changed my running route. I used to just run in the mountains, and I haven't been back. Really? And I'm running on the main road now, just because, like, it's kind of when you hear so many stories, you know, and you realize that it's not just you that's scared. You know, like 2 weeks ago, I was up there running and there was a man walking towards me and, you know, probably was doing nothing wrong. But I felt like, is he acting suspiciously? Why did he stop? So I practically jumped into a bush and got into the field beside the running track just because I just felt unsafe. Yeah. And I have changed my running route. But I know that, you know, your message is that you don't let it change. You know, you would travel alone. And that's an important message, I think, as well, is that we shouldn't have to be living in fear.
Yes, exactly. And I said that I wanted to be very clear that, yes, me talking about this and that article being published isn't, as you said, me saying, this is affecting my life so much, I can't go traveling anymore, I can't wear these outfits anymore. No, I will continue to do all of those things. Now I'm just a bit more feistier, and God help any man that does try to touch me. But that is, you know, we can't, as women, we can't cower away from this terrible, terrible narrative. You know, we need to become stronger and fight together, and we're going to need a lot of help from men as well. But yes, I don't want to have to change my running route or, you know, not do certain things. Actually, the journalist, Philip Boucher-Hayes, I saw he tweeted something really interesting around the time that Sarah's body was found. And he said, you know, as a man, if I'm walking on a street and I come across a woman on her own, what would make that woman feel more comfortable? Should I cross onto the other side of the street? Do I make eye contact with her? How can I make that woman feel less scared? And I thought that was really, really interesting. And more things like that need to happen. Men need to be aware that every woman that they pass is most likely terrified if it's nighttime or if they're alone. And so they need to think, how can I make that woman feel safe? And I don't have the answers, but it's something that we need to talk about.
And speaking then of your travels, and you went on then and you were at the volcanoes, did you finish out a year there?
I did. I went up Akatenango 69 times. I went up Fuego 8 times, and I went up Pacaya 18 times in the 12-month contract. Wow. And
did you say that you then had pepper spray, or did you protect yourself, like, going forward? Did you do anything different?
Yes, I did. I never, ever, ever, ever walked anywhere on my own past like 7 o'clock, to be honest. I ordered this pepper spray keychain off Amazon. Now, I must say that pepper spray is illegal in Ireland, but when I was traveling, it was the perfect tool because it's extremely effective. It's small, you can always have it on you. And I actually, you know, in those countries going through Central and South America, it's the best advice I would give, having a little thing of pepper spray on you, and you can order them on Amazon for like €2.
Okay, that's great. And I'm sure there'll be people listening, you know, all around the world that is such good advice. Because I don't know if you know Daniela Moyles. She used to work in Spain. She has a travel blog, and she's the most adventurous person that I'd ever met. And she travels all around the place by herself, and she's written books, and she seems to be on an amazing journey, as you were too. And what made you come home? I presume, as someone who has a love of travel, it never gets out of your system. It's always going to be there.
Yeah. For so long, I was dreading going home. And to put it simply, I went home because I wanted to go home. It had run its course. I hadn't been home in Ireland in nearly 4 years. You know, I was getting old. And I really missed my mum and dad. My mum and my dad and my brother, they came out to visit me in Guatemala when I was working as a tour guide, because it was somewhere I was settled. So I saw them after about, I don't know, 2 years maybe. But then, yeah, as time went on, I really started to miss them. And I remember dad saying to me before I left, he said, once you stop learning, move on. And so I felt like I wasn't learning anymore in Guatemala. And so I was just like, okay, I think it's time to go home. I also had a dog that I had adopted. I found her on the street when I was coming off the volcano. She was a tiny little puppy, and she was sitting outside a coffin shop, and there were these buses running by. And I was like, oh God, stop the bus. Got out of the bus and I took her with me. And she's actually sitting there beside me on the couch right there.
What's her name?
Her name is Randy. And she was... So I think she was 2 years old when I decided it was time to come home. And so I was just like, yeah, I need to bring Randy home, and she needs to start her life in Ireland and learn English.
Oh, I love it. So you brought a little piece of that world home with you that, you know, you have every day.
Yeah. And it's actually funny. The toy she's cuddling right now is a Mexican candy skull.
Oh, my God.
So she still has her culture in her.
Yeah. And are you still in touch with Rasta Miguel or anybody that you'd met along the way?
I am, actually. Rasta Miguel, he had one of these tiny little, we used to call them frijolitos, which means little bean phones. Like, you know, you're like little Nokia or whatever. And when I was leaving, I was like, Miguel, you need to get a bloody proper phone. Come on, you need to get Instagram so we can keep in contact. And he didn't know what I was talking about. So I got him this phone and set up a little Instagram for him. And so we still communicate through that.
No way.
Yeah, and he asked me on Facebook as well.
That is so cool. And you've spoken as well that you just mentioned it to me during the week that you're going to start a podcast of your own.
Yes,
I am. So tell us about it.
Yes, this is the first time I'm talking about it outside of my own brain. But it's something that I've been working on for about a year now. It's called the Nosy Fox Podcast. And it's a podcast all about people and storytelling. And each episode will be an interview with someone that I either do or do not know until the interview. And it's just seemingly normal people telling rather extraordinary stories.
Oh, wow. I'll be absolutely glued to that podcast. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest today.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Georgie. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, with thanks to Spotlight Oral Care. If you enjoyed this episode, please do leave me a review. You can check out more about my story over on thegoodglow.ie or follow me on Instagram, georgie.crawford.